David Fox wrote a piece for the New York Times Theater Talkback column where he pondered whether it was time to bring booing back to the theater. David has been a guest many times on Radio Times to talk about musical theater, and we asked him back to expand on his article and to join us to talk about audience behaviors. He's a lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in Theater Arts and also the Director of Student Orientation and Academic Initiatives, theater critic for the City Paper. And David Fox, always a pleasure. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be back. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, and we have a bunch of guests that are going to be joining us, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499 about some of the do's and don'ts of behaving when you're part of a large audience. So this article that you wrote about began with opera.
Well, it did. In fact, it started with a question from Eric Piepenberg, who's a friend of mine and is a senior producer at the Times in theater. And he said, "You're the guy I should ask this question to. We've been talking about why it's okay to boo at the opera and not okay to boo at the theater." And he said, you know, I guess he thought of me because I sort of spend about half of my time as a teacher in each of those areas. And you know, it hadn't really occurred to me to think about it in quite that way. But I did understand the point that he was making, that, you know, on the one hand, I think Americans especially tend to think of opera as the sort of
high art, plus ultra, right?
Of this is where we are at. We are a little intimidated. We're on our best behavior when we go, but that's the place where there is a kind of longstanding tradition of booing. Whereas in the theater on Broadway, you almost never hear it. And in fact, sort of the other end of the spectrum, I think, is what people occasionally talk about now, which is this kind of knee jerk standing ovation that seems to happen at the end of anything you see. Good, bad, indifferent—that's come to mean virtually nothing. This wave of enthusiasm, because it's a sort of expected response.
And I want to pick up on all of those. One of the things that you wrote in this New York Times article opera, I guess, in its heyday, or perhaps even performed in other parts of the world, part circus, part blood sport.
Well, you know, I think again, it's always useful to sort of take this out of our arena of expectation, meaning how we would behave when we go to the Met, and remember that in the 19th century, and maybe especially in Italy, which is kind of famous for a certain scrappiness in about audience behavior, that this was a medium about which people had the same kind of strong feelings that they have about a sporting event and wanted to show off how much they knew, and also felt in a way that they were guardians of a kind of tradition. And so, you know, if performers, in their opinion, slipped below that, that it was not just their right, but even a responsibility to kind of call attention to this. And I think in some ways that it was the color of how opera was received, especially in some of, there are certain theaters in Italy and certain cities where they were kind of famous for this. But, you know, I thought about this as I was walking in today, that, you know, La Scala is certainly the most famous of all the Italian opera houses. And La Scala still to this day has, you know, demonstrations. There was not that long ago, there was a tenor who was booed at the end of Celeste Aida, the first aria he sings in Verdi's Aida, and got annoyed and kind of threw in the towel and walked off.
Wow.
And, you know, the public face that's always put on this is that they're embarrassed. You know, they're always Italian politicians and ministers of culture who come out and say, you know, we should be above this. But I also think that the not expressed part of this is people are kind of proud that tradition hasn't completely ebbed away, and fundamentally that people care so much about this that they wear their emotions on their sleeve to the degree that they'll display it.
But I'm trying to imagine, and I am clearly not an opera singer, but trying to imagine performing and being booed. I mean, how could you not be mortified?
Well, so, you know, one of the distinctions that I drew here was to talk about sort of when you boo. And, you know, booing at the curtain call when the show is essentially over and it's the audience's moment for feedback is one thing. Look, it's tough. I'm sure it's tough. But I will also say that there's a way in which I think it kind of fuels a feeling about the performance that gives it a kind of high-risk glamour. Not booing specifically, but the sense that what you are doing is about to be judged in a way that you'll know right away.
Right.
And whether that's cheers or boos. And and that people are kind of sitting on the edge of their seat. And there is something about, you know, there's particular kinds of operatic writing, maybe the very virtuosic kind of stuff, which is almost like, you know, I sometimes wonder why people don't hold up numbers like they would do at the Olympics, because it is, it's like there are sort of various hoops you jump through. And when you get them right, it's an incredible thrill. And when you get them wrong, it's a big risk. But it also sort of fuels the excitement for when you get it right.
But are you arguing or saying that American opera audiences should feel empowered or even entitled to boo when they feel that there's a performance worth booing?
Am I arguing that? So I guess I would say fundamentally, I do believe that it's the right of the audience to respond, certainly at the curtain call. I mean, in the same way that if you ask somebody for their opinion, they have the right to give you a negative one, right? Mm-hmm. When it comes to interrupting a piece in the middle, I think that context has a lot to do with it. And, you know, I believe that one of the reasons, for example, that I think it doesn't happen much at the theater, is the American theatrical tradition for most of the 20th century is realism. That is to say, we want to sort of feel that this is a world that's going on that's not being observed, right? That the famous fourth wall convention. And to interrupt that would be a real breach of our understanding of the style. In opera, especially, you know, there's a tradition of people actually bowing after arias, even in the middle of an opera. Now, that's, I have to say, in good ways, that's going away, I think. But I do feel that if the context is an understanding that the theater is a place where there's a lot of vocal response, certain kinds of works, which are sort of a succession of various kinds of pieces, virtuoso pieces, I think it's okay to cheer, and I think it's equally okay to boo. Mm.
You also wrote in this piece about going to see Annie Get Your Gun, and this was a performance starring Debbie Reynolds,
yes,
and you were sitting next to a friend,
this
friend booed her performance.
It was. I have to say, I've sort of dined out on this story for many years,
and my
dear friend, whose name I will not reveal, knows this, but okay, what can I say about this? We were young, and I think we probably thought we knew a lot more than we did, but we also felt like, you know, that guardian of the threshold, like we just wanted to be, we cared so much about the theater that we wanted to make sure it was done to a standard that we expected. And his view, which I have to say I shared, was that she was kind of giving a nightclub style performance, which was really, in a way, calling out to the audience to respond in inappropriately. And after a particular moment of this, I was shocked to hear it, but there was a boo coming from right next to me. And I will tell you, we were in like the first row of the mezzanine, so it was very noticeable. And there was a kind of shocked silence that descended on the theater. And what I said in the article is, I felt in a way a very complicated set of emotions. I was certainly embarrassed.
And
I wondered if we get out alive. But I also thought, like, imagine caring so much about this, about Annie Get Your Gun, a kind of lightweight musical, that you felt called upon to respond this way. And you know, what I would have said to somebody who would come up to us and say, you know, this is gross and inappropriate, is we cared about it. He cared about it. That's why he responded that way.
But you came to your own resolution in this article that if you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but if you don't like a performance and you're sitting in there and you paid a lot of money for a ticket, as we do, you don't have to clap. In a sense, you call this the silent treatment. That is a way of expressing one's displeasure.
You don't. Now, and I will say, you'll get dirty looks from other people in the audience, because the expectation is that you are, especially these days, that you are going to be on your feet and cheering. But you certainly don't have to clap. Right. You can leave early, which is very showy.
I've seen that. I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, but you can. You have other venues apart from booing and staying, other opportunities. No, I don't think I would. And part of it is that, you know, in my current life, I'm a theater critic, and I think as a theater critic, you make certain deals and you have certain responsibilities. And for better or for worse, there's a kind of expectation that people will look to you as a person who has a kind of a privileged point of view about this. And so I would not do it anymore. I don't think I ever really did it, and I would not do it anymore. But
actually, I did it once, now that I think of it.
Is that right? Was it a concert? Was it a...
No, it was Al Pacino playing Richard III. It was in Philadelphia. I mean, this was years and years ago, and I was the most appalling performance, and I do remember walking out.
Well, and then the question is sort of, what is it appropriate to boo? And, you know, my feeling is, I think the way I put it in the article is, you know, mere incompetence isn't enough. That when somebody, in fact, it's really, that's kind of sad, when somebody's trying hard and it's just not happening. But I think... So what I think of as grandstanding, these kind of egregious things, or just or not essentially having done the work that you put into, you know, I've seen performances that you can tell are lazy.
Yeah, I was
essentially
gonna say lazy
people don't know what they're doing, you know, haven't really thrown themselves into it. That's more worthy.
But it's interesting. I mean, we're talking about booing and applauding, but you also say that there's now the obligatory standing ovation. And does that mean people, they just don't know either what's good, or they just feel they want to express all this enthusiasm for something that they just saw, or we just lost our way?
it's a good question, and I think there are multiple answers. You know, there's certainly one cynical answer, but it's one that's often offered, is, you know, if you've paid $200 to go to see a Broadway show, and if you've taken your family, you've paid $1,000 to do it, you want to think you've had a great time, and you can sort of shape your own behavior to make that feel part of what you did. I also think that people are often cowed by reviews. And if a piece gets a lot of good reviews, a couple of things can happen. Mm-hmm. You can see a certain backlash. And I think this does happen with plays and musicals where people have where there have been kind of love letters from critics, that there's this kind of, oh, it's not that great. But maybe more often, the mm-hmm. response is, well, it must be great because the New Yorker told me it was, or the New York Times told me that it was. And I think, you know, audiences are often reluctant to trust themselves.
But, and we're almost up on a break here, but does that then make the standing ovation then just less meaningful? I'm wondering, even for performers, if they come to expect it, and if you come to expect it, does it really mean what it's supposed to mean?
I think it does. And one of the things I try hard to do as a critic is, you know, people, you don't want to give... Even when you see something that you're enthusiastic about, you want to sort of put it on a scale which allows you to recognize the truly extraordinary. And, you know, to me, a standing ovation is something that should happen a few times in a mm-hmm. lifetime of theater going. It should be the ultimate special tribute.
And that's David Fox, our guest, our one of several guests in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about booing and applauding and standing ovations, and about audience behavior at public events, whether it's an opera, a play, a movie, a sporting event. And we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 23rd at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates can be found online at mfsopportunities.org. mfsopportunities.org.
Zahav was one of the first restaurants of its kind in downtown Philadelphia. Go behind the scenes of a feast for all senses, the Rowdy Purim celebration. Visit former PAFA teacher Elizabeth Osborne's retrospective, The Color of Light, and learn about the artist and her work. With the simple goal of comforting needy children, Quilts for Kids now reaches across North America and the Caribbean. Friday Arts.
Tomorrow night at 8:30 on WHYY-TV.
The Greater Wildwood Chamber of Commerce supports WHYY and presents the Greater Wildwood Fabulous 50s Weekend, October 14th and 15th. Highlights include a Friday night dance party featuring Jerry Blavitt and a live concert featuring five 50s acts, with the headliner being Little Anthony and the Imperials. Also on Saturday is a street fair, open to the public with live music and vendors. For tickets and information, gwcoc.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We are talking about booing and cheering. David Fox from the University of Pennsylvania staying with us for the full hour. And as you know, Philadelphia is a sports-crazed town, and no one is more obsessed than former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. He's a regular on Comcast Sportsnet Eagles post-game live show and joins us on Radio Times to talk about the reputation, deserved or otherwise, of the Philadelphia sports fan. And Governor Rendell, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. In fact, you know, I write a weekly sports column for the Daily News, and one of my columns earlier was on booing, when it's appropriate to boo and when it's not appropriate to boo.
So when is it appropriate to boo? And we're talking about a sports venue.
Yeah, of course.
Here.
Lack of effort. If there's any athlete, professional, who clearly demonstrates lack of effort, I think it is absolutely appropriate to boo significantly. I think you can boo the introduction of the opposing team in pro, not in college. Absolutely appropriate. I think you can boo a bad call by an umpire or referee. Absolutely appropriate. You know, we pay a lot of money, we fans, to attend sporting events, and booing is one of our sacred rights, particularly in Philadelphia, but not exclusively in Philadelphia. You know, it always drove me crazy that the networks would, you know, focus on bad behavior by Philadelphia fans and totally ignore similar acts conducted all around the country. In fact, in my column, I assess that. And, you know, in Dodger Stadium, they shoot people. On two occasions, the fans have shot, you know, people from who are rooting for opposing teams. We've never done anything close to that.
But we did have a court in the old Vet.
Yeah, but that was a court for people who were intoxicated and basically inflicted harm upon themselves. And we did have a court, and it worked in the old Vet. It certainly helped correct and maintain the problem. I think one of the problems, and it's a problem for all professional sports, is the intake of alcohol.
Right, and there is a lot of intake of alcohol.
A lot of intake in alcohol. I was at the Sunday night Phillies game, and I was sitting in the lower deck, a little bit behind third base, and I was stunned. I kept count of how many beer vendors I saw in a nine-inning game, and actually they cut it off after the seventh inning. I think it broke three figures. I think it was over 100 beer vendors went down hawking beer. And you know, that's not uncommon to the Phillies or the Eagles, etc. You know, I remember when I was having the dispute about whether or not we should have called the football game off because of the snowstorm.
The nation of wusses, right?
And the Eagles' response was we were doing it to protect our fans from, you know, we didn't want them to drive in bad condition. Well, yet they sell unlimited beer up until the fourth quarter to their fans, and I would submit to you that driving intoxicated is a lot more dangerous than driving through snow.
What about cursing?
Cursing is inappropriate because sports, in its last analysis, is best spectated when it's kids who are doing the watching. And if I brought my six-year-old son or daughter to the game, I wouldn't want to hear cursing. I wouldn't want to hear, you know. Now, again, it depends on what you consider cursing. certainly the traditional curse words are verboten, but if you want to say, Dallas sucks, yeah, I think that's okay.
Speaking of Dallas.
And Dallas, just for the record, Dallas does suck.
Speaking of Dallas, though, Governor, how about encouraging people to throw snowballs at Dallas Cowboy players?
Well, actually, Marty, you've fallen into believing Steve Lopez, and you know you can't believe the press about anything. That was a totally
You're a part of the press
argument,
now, you know.
Totally inaccurate article. What I did was I tried to stop these guys from throwing snowballs because I thought they might hit the players or the coaches. And what I said to them is, I'll give you guys $20 if you can throw a snowball and reach the field, not where the players. The players were down on the goal line. We were sitting on the 50-yard line. I said, but one caveat, and that is, I didn't say caveat to them.
No.
I said, if you reach the field and take the $20, you got to stop throwing snowballs. They wound up. The guy reached the field. It bounced harmlessly on the field. He took my $20, and not only did he stop throwing snowballs, they left. because the beer, it was the fourth quarter, and they were no longer selling beer. So I'm sure they took the $20 and went outside the stadium to buy more beer. So I actually averted potential harm.
But you know this is going to follow you to your grave, Governor.
It has certainly done me a lot of political damage.
So are you saying that the Philadelphia sports fans' reputation for being rude and unruly
is overblown,
undeserved?
When you compare the mayhem that occurs in other stadiums compared to the basic lack of mayhem. I mean, we boo. We throw snowballs at Santa Claus, but nobody got hurt. We don't essentially threaten a referee or an umpire's life. I mean, it is totally overblown, and it's overblown because of a couple of colorful incidents like the Santa Claus incident. But if you were there and I was there, Marty, that Santa Claus was woeful looking. That was a woeful-looking Santa, number one. Number two, the fans were mad because the Eagles were about 1-12 that season. And we were in contention, I think, to get Jim Plunkett in the draft. And the fans wanted us to lose this game so we could get Jim Plunkett. And, in fact, we were winning at halftime. So it was a horrible combination of things, and we did drive Santa off the sleigh.
Well, and a woeful Santa, I guess he was. Governor Rendell, thank you for joining us today
pleasure.
In Radio Times.
We get a bum rap.
I hear you.
And I'm willing to stack our fans for their positive, the things that they do positively. When our teams ask our fans to contribute money, it's overwhelming. I'd stack our fans on a positive sense up against any fans in the country.
Well, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thanks,
on Radio Times. You're welcome.
And Dallas does suck. See ya.
And that's former Pennsylvania Governor Ed Rendell. And yes, he is one of the more obsessed sports fans here in Philadelphia. And we are talking about behavior, whether it has to do in the opera, in a sports stadium, in the theater. And David Fox is our guest. And let me get a couple of calls, and then I do want to get a film critic to join us on Radio Times. But we had so many people call in. David, let me see what Anne from Wincote has to say. And Anne, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My husband and I have been going to the opera in Philadelphia for the last few years, and it's really our first opera experience.
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of thought there might be some booing at the opera from what we'd heard about the Met and opera in Italy. And we haven't heard a single boo. So I'm not disappointed, but I was just curious, is it just New York, or are we missing something?
Well, let me see what David Fox has to say, and thanks for calling in.
No, it isn't. It certainly isn't just New York. I would say the first thing is that this is far less true in the United States than it is in European countries. Just in general, the tradition is stronger there. The other thing, and it's a point I tried to make when I wrote about this, is that I think booing in the opera has now shifted to be about, rather than really a display against the performers who were thought to be inadequate, it's more a kind of line of protest against updating, this kind of knee-jerk idea of updating works out of their historical context into something else, and a certain kind, which became a hugely prevalent part of opera direction. So one of the things I think that you may be seeing in the Philadelphia Opera is, I think they've done some updated productions, but I think they've been quite respectful and traditional about their approach to works, which is one of the reasons that I think people that audiences may not respond by booing. I also think that that there is a real feeling in Philadelphia of civic pride about our opera company, and that there is a lot of enthusiasm about it, and in general, good behavior.
And thanks for calling into Radio Times. Before we get to Piers Marchant in, let me just give you a chance to respond, David, to what the governor was saying about sports fans. And, you know, you talked about the kind of sports mentality of traditional opera.
You know, so a couple of things that jumped out at me. One was that I really kind of appreciated that he had a very thought through code of behavior, and it was quite clear in his own mind about exactly what was okay and what wasn't. And I think as audience members, that's a good thing to do if you're entertaining the idea of how to handle this.
So you can say Dallas sucks, right?
You can say Dallas sucks. The other thing was that the first thing you said that you asked him sort of what is okay to boo was I can't remember.
Poor performance.
Poor performance, and but lack of effort, I think, was what he was specifically what he said. And I think, you know, that's analogous to something that I was talking about, which is I feel like if you can tell that a performer has really not put in the time and done, seems careless or disengaged, that is a booable offense in any format that I can think of, as opposed to just like trying but not getting it.
Well, I'm a pretty even-tempered person, but I have absolutely no patience for people talking or texting in the movie theater. And I attended the Toronto International Film Festival with my family last summer, and one of the great pleasures was just how quiet the audience was. Let me get Piers Martin to join us on Radio Times. He's a film critic for NBC and for 215 Magazine, which is based out of Philly. And Piers Martin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to have you here. How about for you? Do you have a certain kind of etiquette about how people are supposed to behave in a movie theater?
Well, I mean, I think there's a sort of gold standard ideal that it seems to be just about everyone should fully understand at this point, which is keep your talking to a bare minimum, and if you must say something, say it in the softest whisper you can. Your cell phone should be turned off. You should not be jostling around in your seat or opening plastic wrappers at crucial points in the film. You can wait for a swelling part of the soundtrack, I guess, to open your jujubes or whatever. these things seem to be universally understood, and I think if you ask any moviegoer, you know, how do you expect an audience to react, that's more or less what they would say. The curious thing is you don't often get that in movie theaters. Depending on the film you're going and the time of day, I guess, you still have people. In fact, I saw a movie over this past weekend with my family, just not as a work thing, and there was an incredibly loudish guy behind us who had taken his shoes off and was spreading his bare feet all over the seat in front of him and was talking to his wife just in a regular conversation voice, and I almost couldn't believe it, but it, of course, this still happens all the time.
And what did you do, Piers?
Well, I have to say, I was kind of the furthest point away from him, so even if I had turned around, he wouldn't have seen me. My brother-in-law finally turned around and just said, please, just please. And he more or less discounted it and just kept on talking, which is, I think, what you get a lot. Unfortunately,
I have a theory. It's not a particularly original one, but that I think people have brought their TV watching behavior into the movie theater.
That seems to be part of it, but there's also, I think you sort of have a classification here of maybe three different types of people going to films. They're the people that I think more or less know how to act, know how to be courteous to other people around them, and just go to watch the movie and take it in. There are people who really want to go and enjoy the movie, but part of their enjoyment is sort of engagement with the movie. So they might, you know, if it's a horror movie especially, they might yell and scream at this scary moment, which, honestly, I think that's fine. If you know going into it, like, this is what this audience is going to be like, I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with that. It might be a screening I would choose to avoid, but I can understand why people would kind of enjoy that experience. The third kind of person, though, which is maybe the type you're talking about, they just don't care.
Yeah.
They really do not care.
Let me give David Fox a chance to weigh in on this, and we've been talking about opera, theater, sports. You see movies any differently, or just part of this continuum?
I don't think they should be any different. I agree on all counts with what Pierce has been saying, and to be honest, to me, booing is a very minor offense in comparison to texting, talking, cell phone conversations. I grew up in Los Angeles. I've been in Philadelphia now for 20 years. So in some ways, it's hard for me to balance my sense of these audiences, in part because technology has changed and in part because, you know, times have changed. But I will say that, you know, Los Angeles, it's a company town, and going to the movies is a kind of serious business for people, and they care a lot about it. And when people ask me what I miss about living in Los Angeles, I have to say I love Philadelphia. There's not much that I miss. I miss that people went to the movies with a kind of excitement and respect and treated it like it was an event. And I love going to the movies.
Me too.
As much as I love going to any other kind of theater, but I have to say it's tapered off to be very, I almost never do it. And that breaks my heart.
And for these particular reasons, because you just know
not,
that
it's not a pleasant experience.
It's going to
That's not true of every theater or every movie, but, you know, it's exhausting to try to figure out when it's going to be okay. And so I find myself not going, and that's bad.
Piers, I want to get some callers in and see if we have anyone that wants to weigh in on this behavior in movie theaters. And that line is 1-888-477-9499. And, I mean, I have gotten into arguing matches with people in movies. There was one time and I left and I had some back and forth with someone and I was afraid they were going to jump me in the parking lot.
Yeah, no, it's a scary. It can be scary.
Very scary. And I've also found, Piers, that when you go to get the manager, and I've done that, you know, the manager is 17 years old, and, right. and you're bringing him into a situation that, frankly, they're just not, you know, capable. They haven't been trained to deal with.
You know, I was reading recently about some movie theater that was getting some praise and some flack about having these very kind of sharp standards that, you know, you would get thrown out if you spoke, if you talked, and they would confiscate your cell phone, and you and nobody under 12. Right. And I have to say, I thought, where's the address? I'm that's where I'm going.
What do you think, Beers? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, possibly the most egregious example I've ever encountered was a press screening. This is now years ago, but a press screening for Boys Don't Cry.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Which is a very intense, dramatic film, and it builds slowly, and then, you know, by the last third of the film, you can feel yourself kind of clutching harder and harder because you kind of know what's coming. About that point in the film, about two-thirds of the way in, a woman's cell phone went off, and it was some sort of sing-song melody, which was pretty loud. Even the theater was dead quiet except for the soundtrack. Her phone goes off, and she answers it and talks in a fairly regular voice, just, you know, says a few lines to whoever it is, hangs up, and I think people were you know, honest, well, justifiably annoyed at that point. So we keep going. Film is building in more and more intention. Maybe half hour later, her phone rings again. And at this point, someone very close to wherever she was sitting said, and he used a profanity that I will not add here, but he said, turn off your phone. And she, rather than be chagrined and turn it off, she actually started yelling at him. And it became this huge fracas back and forth with them screaming at each other, and essentially I totally understand what he was trying to do, but it ended up just thoroughly disrupting everything, and it became like this 5-minute altercation that I have to say probably ruined the movie for everyone in the theater. So I'm not sure what the answer would have been there.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sorry to hear something like that happen. And I guess the flip side of this appears, and we're almost out of time here before we have to say goodbye. One of the great pleasures of going to a movie with other people is when you get to laugh together and cry together and be scared together and have this group experience.
That is a huge draw. I mean, everyone, or a lot of people, have giant flat screens and home theater systems. They can watch movies at home, but that's you're right. That's exactly what you're missing if you do that. You don't get the collective audience experience. It's just that's obviously a kind of double-edged sword.
Well, Piers, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times, and good luck going to the movie theater.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. Piers Martin, film critic for NBC and for 215 Magazine. David Fox, lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania in theater arts, staying with us for the rest of the hour. Also theater critic for the City Paper. And we have an etiquette expert staying or joining us next after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps private foundations by partnering on administration and grant making. Private foundations also can establish a donor-advised fund to save time and reduce costs. What's more, the Philadelphia Foundation also offers solutions when a private foundation has run its course. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philofound.org.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Once seen as a haven for draft dodgers during the Vietnam era, the National Guard has gone back to one of its original missions, fighting wars. Also, IBM's supercomputer Watson helps doctors diagnose patients. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Devon Prep, a private Catholic college preparatory school for young men in grades 6 through 12. Through challenging academics, a devotion to Christian values, competitive athletics, and a commitment to service, Devon Prep students can receive the foundation necessary to face the challenges of life with confidence. On Sunday, October 9th, from 1 to 4 p.m., Devon Prep will host an open house on their campus in Devon, Chester County. More at devonprep.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. So is it ever okay to boo at an opera or at a theater performance or at a concert? It's been a longstanding tradition for sports fans here in Philadelphia to boo at events. And we heard from sports enthusiast Governor Ed Rendell about the do's and don'ts of behaving in movie theaters, at sporting events. We also were just talking about people talking and texting in movie theaters. And we are talking about the do's and don'ts of audience behavior and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have Anna Post waiting in the wings, but first let me get Julie from Princeton to join our conversation. And Julie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi,
thank you.
You're welcome.
I was recently, last week, with my husband at the Revival of Follies on Broadway, and it was a wonderful show, but I was very struck. In the beginning of the show, people are coming out to come to a party. And I think Bernadette Peters came out first, and she got a round of applause. But then each subsequent person that came out, maybe eight of them, some of them not even necessarily famous, got this round of applause. And then later on in the scene, the actresses are coming down a flight of stairs as part of the drama, kind of presenting themselves. And again, each one got a round of applause. And there were many people clapping, but I felt it interrupted the show completely as they had to wait until the applause stopped. Everything was kind of timed about it. And that was my comment.
Well, that's interesting, Julie. Let me give David Fox a chance to weigh in on that.
Well, you know, I think Follies is an example of a show. And, of course, this is the, I guess, third Broadway production that it's had. And it is a much beloved show. That's the first thing I'll say. That there's a kind of a, because in a way it's about the death of one kind of theater. And has a long tradition of casting performers who have had long careers in the theater, even those who are not especially well known. That I think there is a feeling many audiences feel strongly about sort of supporting the show and supporting the performers involved. And I know exactly the moment you're talking about, and I think every production of Follies that I've seen has used that, which is the entrance of these former showgirls into this party where they're sort of brought on as if they were in the show. And I actually think in some cases the directors really want that applause, and they've staged it in such a way to try to get it because they want to build a certain enthusiasm. And I take your point that in some ways it breaks the frame of it, but I think it's actually almost built into the way Follies is often staged, that it's a way of recognizing what the show is about and rewarding these performers who are part of it.
Julie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me get Anna Post in on the conversation, co-author of Emily Post's Etiquette, the 18th edition. And she is the great-great-granddaughter of Emily Post and works with her family at the Emily Post Institute in Burlington, Vermont. And Anna Post, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back again.
Well, you're very welcome. We've been talking about opera, theater, concerts, sporting events, and movies as well. Are there some do's and don'ts that cover all these public venues?
Sure. You know, as an audience member, being respectful of either the players, if we're talking about sports, or the performers when we're talking more about the arts, either way, you do want to be respectful of that performance. Now, there's ways you can do that and still be a very enthusiastic fan. I would be lying if I said I had never booed at a hockey game. But there are lines that you don't want to cross. Getting into any more of the genuine anger side, booing in certain events can also be a deep sign of disrespect.
But I wonder, and actually Governor Rendell was saying, as it applies to sports fans, that if an athlete, a player, is not, in a sense, working hard, not really showing their stuff on the field, that is something worth booing. Do you agree?
And I have to say that given a certain scenario, I might be the one doing the booing myself. I like I said, I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. Where I would cross the line, or think that it was crossing the line, for example, would be booing at a child's sporting event, for example, which sadly does happen. That is not okay in any circumstance.
And these are these crazed parents on the sidelines, right, that we hear so much about.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And is there a point in which, and in fact, David Fox is with us, was talking about that in opera, there is a kind of tradition of booing that you might see in Europe, you might not see in the United States. Does booing in an opera, does Emily Post have a position on that kind of behavior?
Sure. Our position is no on that. If you're in Italy, sure. When in Rome, very appropriate here, do as the Romans do. In fact, one of my uncles is a huge opera aficionado, and he says they'll even bring rotten fruit in Italy to throw. Thankfully, we stopped short of that here in the U.S., but even though this does happen, and I've read some accounts of this happening, at the Met in New York even, the ultimate opera house in the U.S., it doesn't mean that it's widely accepted by fans, that it happens, sure, and it makes an interesting conversation piece for why it might have been happening. In one case, it was art direction that people really opposed to. But no, within the general opera community, you don't boo. No, not here in the U.S.
And if someone is at any of these events and wants to express their displeasure, one of the things that David talked about was essentially the silent treatment, which is if a performance isn't worthy of applause, then don't applaud. Are you okay with that?
I am A-okay with that. I'm also okay with not giving standing ovations to every performance we see. It keeps it from being special when it might actually be deserved.
And that was something else, David, you were saying as well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree.
This obligatory standing ovation. Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Just one open line at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Phil from Atlantic City, I guess. And Phil, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
It's Atlanta, Georgia.
Atlanta, Georgia. I'm sorry there. Go ahead, Phil.
Well, I just wanted to give a perspective as a lifelong rock and roll concert goer and contrast the obligatory standing ovation with the obligatory encore that you might see a live band perform, and how it appears that in, certainly popular music or any kind of larger touring show, the encore is a scripted part of the show, and it's just something that they're holding out their, top hit or some kind of song like that. And whereas at one point in time that was kind of a special treat that the audience got if it was a good performance, sure, and everyone was kind of in sync. With rock and roll, the crowd and the band interaction is very two-way. And so if you have a good vibe, sometimes the bands will want to treat you to an encore, and they'll come out and go beyond their allotted time.
Well,
and
Phil,
that's the exciting part.
Indeed. And Phil, let me give David Fox a chance to weigh in on that. David, go
ahead. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about. And in fact, there is a comparable tradition in classical music. Certainly, I go to a lot of recitals by classical singers, and there is an encore often at the end. In fact, when I say often, it's really come to be a kind of pro forma exercise that it's coming. My guess is that many years ago, it was really something that happened when there was an especially appreciative audience, and it was a kind of a scripted piece. But it's certainly come to be that you can expect anywhere from 2 to 4 encores, and to some extent, it's robbed, in classical music, the degree to which this is now essentially part of the program. The only thing that's different about it is it's not published in the program, and it's robbed it of any specialness. I mean, it's still enjoyable, but it doesn't feel like it's a genuine response.
Phil, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let me get Mark from Cherry Hill to join our conversation. And Mark, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to just offer the brainstorm idea that it would be helpful if every movie was actually introduced by someone.
Like an actual human being?
Right. Welcome to the 7:30 showing of such and such at such and such. We ask that you refrain from your cell phone and speaking and such. If you have a page, please remove yourself to the lobby. And we ask this request because we've had incidents where we had to remove individuals, and we hope you enjoy the show, etc.
Well, Mark, let me see what Anna Post has to say about that. Anna?
I think it never hurts to have that message come from management. It's certainly a lot easier than having patrons try to police each other. It doesn't mean you certainly can't shush someone. I think I may have done that once upon a time in a movie theater myself, when someone wouldn't get off a cell phone or put away, you know, a lit up screen of texting. But the degree to which it's going to be effective in part depends a little bit more on the audience than the message. Some people, they're just not going to hear it no matter who it comes from. Now, that doesn't make it okay, but I do think that, yes, having it come from a live person could be a little bit more effective than the message that's pre-programmed that we've heard before that's easy to tune out.
That says silence is golden and yeah. No one is actually paying attention. David, any thoughts about that?
Yeah, no, I absolutely think that that's right. And I also think that having a person there would send the message that's important, that management is on board with keeping their theater a place where it's pleasant to see movies if you are a real serious moviegoer who doesn't want to talk and text and wants to see the movie in silence.
And I'm interested that you did shush someone in a movie theater. So what's the etiquette as, you know, you shush and then if they don't be quiet or stop texting, what's the next level of etiquette in dealing with that?
Then you'd go and talk to management at that point. And I have to say, you know, management plays a role here, too. For these policies to be effective, they need to follow through. I think it was the theater, and maybe you've already talked about this in Texas, that famously kicked out a woman for, and the person I actually shushed, I think I used shush generically, I think I actually tapped a college student in front of me and asked them to, if they would stop texting. And I promise I asked very nicely. This Texas theater, when they kicked out this person, she called and left a nasty message about how dare you kick me out for texting, and they took it as a point of pride and actually made it into an advertisement that was wildly popular with the public. It really, she was on the wrong side of public sentiment there, and it showed.
Anything you want to add to that, David?
No, that may be, in fact, be the story I was trying to think about. I think... You know, the audiences are sick of this, yeah, by and large, but that doesn't stop enough people from doing it, that it's difficult to go. And you know what? I wish I could say that this doesn't happen in the theater, but it does, in the live theater, where you'd really think
texting,
that anybody with texting any brains would realize that that a lit screen is visible not only to the other audience members, but to the performers. But, you know, I was at the theater last night, and somebody was texting, and I just somebody who was, I think, otherwise enjoying the show. But it's just, I think we've crossed a behavioral line of just not even understanding that what we do is visible to others.
Well, let me pick up on that, and I'll toss that to you. Then we'll get back to our callers. But I think because we can so easily bring our private lives into these public venues. I take the train, and you hear people talking on phones, and say, you know, this is not a conversation you should be having when other people can listen. We have access to all this stuff, and then it's hard to say no to it. Anna?
It is. You know, one of the things about technology these days when we're talking about our, you know, cell phones and smartphones, technology itself isn't rude or polite. It's how we're choosing to use it that makes a difference. We have a choice that we need to make, and here's the thing. These devices are made to be convenient, and I'm generally a fan of that. I think the whole world is, as we're seeing in the outpouring of praise for, you know, in the wake of Steve Jobs', you know, unfortunate death recently. And convenience isn't always our number one priority, though. Just because we can check in with the babysitter on the cell phone, sometimes as a call or a text, in the middle of a live performance or a movie theater, doesn't mean that we should. So I think convenience sometimes is a little bit of a double-edged sword.
Let me get Martin, looks like from Old Kensington, to join us on Radio Times. And Martin, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Good, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Listen, I got a story as an anecdote from about 10 years ago when I was living in Seattle. And my dad and my brother and I, went to go see Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And this was at the Neptune Theater, the small independent theater, unfortunately just closed down, I heard. And we went to go see this, and my brother sold it to us like it was some type of supernatural kung fu flick. We had no idea what kind of movie it was. And about 10 minutes in, my dad has this bad habit of talking at movie theaters. It's been going on for a long time, and we dealt with it this time just by being quiet. He's sitting in between my brother and I. We're being quiet, not encouraging him. He keeps talking, and then at this moment when the screen, I recall, was especially bright. This Buddhist monk who was sitting in front of us, we didn't notice. He rises up, and the lights from the theater shine on his head, and he looks back at us, and he's wearing the red robe, and his head is bald, and he puts his finger to his mouth and loudly and forcefully shushes us.
Wow. And did your dad stay quiet, Martin?
Oh, yeah.
Did that break him of his habit forevermore?
Oh, no, not at all. But in that particular incident, we respected that monk, man.
Oh, yeah.
That guy was he was impressive. That's how you make people be quiet in movie theater.
I'm going to remember that. Martin, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much. And we're nearly out of time here. David, is this just the world we have to get used to, do you think? Or can we bring some law and order to some of these events?
Well, I actually think that I'd like to think there's already been a kind of a tipping point that that enough people, that the story that about the Texas movie theater is a good example, really have sort of come to the point that we won't tolerate it anymore. It's going to be a combination of things. Yeah. I think in general, there will be some positive changes in behavior on that level, but I also think we're going to have to live with a lot of it.
And what do you think, Anna?
I agree in part. I think that we're always going to have new things like a cell phone coming in to potentially disrupt and disturb, but the fact that people still talk about it is annoying, that they want it changed, they want more policies, and we see those happening, tells me that we still care about maintaining that experience as, in this case, viewers at an event.
Well, Anna Post, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. And David Fox, as always, thank you for joining us as well.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Us as well. And go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, yesterday we started a conversation on our Facebook page about this very subject, so do go there and do weigh in. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll